How did he pass through the storm of the peasant war? How did he steer clear of the Reds? I cannot make anything out. And then, what kind of shapka-nevidimka, invisible-making cap, could have fitted him who would have worn even that at a rakish angle? Did he hide in fishermen's huts, as Kruger supposes, at the post Aralskoye More among the stolid Ural's old believers? And if he died, how did he die? What is your profession, Pugachev asked the astronomer Lovitz. Counting the stars? Whereupon they hanged him so he could be nearer the stars. Oh, how did he die? From illness? From exposure? From thirst? By the hand of man? And if by somebody's hand? Can that hand be still living, taking bread, raising a glass, chasing flies, stirring, pointing, beckoning, lying motionless, shaking other hands? Did he return their fire for a long time? Did he save a last bullet for himself? Was he taken alive? Did they bring him to the parlor car at the railway headquarters of some punitive detachment? I can see its hideous locomotive stoked with dried fish. Having suspected him of being a white spy? And not without reason. He knew well the white general Lavr Kornilov, with whom once in his youth he had traveled over the steppe of despair, and whom in later years he had seen in China. Did they shoot him in the ladies' room of some godforsaken station? Broken-looking glass, tattered plush. Or did they lead him out into some kitchen garden one dark night and wait for the moon to peep out? How did he wait with them in the dark? With a smile of disdain? And if a whitish moth had hovered among the shadowy burdocks, he would, even at that moment, I know, have followed it with that same glance of encouragement with which on occasion after evening tea, smoking his pipe in our Leshino garden, he used to greet the pink hawks sampling our lilacs. But sometimes I get the impression that all this is a rubbishy rumor, a tired legend, that it has been created out of those same suspicious granules of approximate knowledge that I use myself when my dreams muddle through regions known to me only by hearsay or out of books, so that the first knowledgeable person who has really seen at the time the places referred to will refuse to recognize them, will make fun of the exoticism of my thoughts, the hills of my sorrow, the precipices of my imagination, and will find in my conjectures just as many topographical errors as he will anachronisms. So much the better. Once the rumor of my father's death is a fiction, must it not then be conceded that his very journey out of Asia is merely attached in the shape of a tale to this fiction, like that kite which in Pushkin's story young Grignov fashioned out of a map, and that perhaps if my father even did set out on this return journey, and was not dashed to pieces in an abyss, not held in captivity by Buddhist monks, he chose a completely different road. I have even had occasion to hear surmises, sounding like belated advice, that he could well have proceeded west to Ladakh in order to go south into India. Or why could he not have pushed on to China, and from there, on any ship, to any port in the world? Whether it was this way or that, Mother, all material connected with his life is now collected at my place. Out of swarms of drafts, long manuscript extracts from books, indecipherable jottings on miscellaneous sheets of paper, penciled remarks straggling over the margins of other writings of mine, out of half-crossed-out sentences, unfinished words, and improvidently abbreviated, already forgotten names hiding from full view among my papers, out of the fragile staticism of irredeemable information already destroyed in places by a too swift movement of thought, which in turn dissolved into nothingness. Out of all this, I must now make a lucid, orderly book. At times I feel that somewhere it has already been written by me, that it is here, hiding in this inky jungle, that I've only to free it part by part from the darkness, and the parts will fall together of themselves. But what is the use of that to me, when this labor of liberation now seems to me so difficult and complicated, and when I'm so much afraid I might dirty it with a flashy phrase, or wear it out in the course of transfer onto paper, that I already doubt whether the book will be written at all. You yourself wrote to me of the demands which in such a task should be presupposed, but now I am of the opinion that I would fulfill them badly. Do not scold me for weakness and cowardice. Sometime I shall read you at random, disjointed, and inchoate extracts from what I have written. How little it resembles my statuesque dream! All these months, while I was making my research, taking notes, recollecting and thinking, I was blissfully happy. I was certain that something unprecedentedly beautiful was being created, that my notes were merely small props for the work, trail marks, pegs, and that the most important thing was developing and being created of itself. But now I see, like waking up on the floor, that besides these pitiful notes, there is nothing. What shall I do? You know, when I read his or Grum's books, and I hear their entrancing rhythm, when I study the position of the words that can neither be replaced nor rearranged, it seems to me a sacrilege to take all this and dilute it with myself. If you like, I'll admit it. I myself am a mere seeker of verbal adventures. And forgive me if I refuse to hunt down my fancies on my father's own collecting ground. I have realized, you see, the impossibility of having the imagery of his travels germinate without contaminating them with a kind of secondary poetization, which keeps departing further and further from that real poetry with which the live experience of these receptive, knowledgeable, and chaste naturalists endowed their research. "Of course I understand and sympathize," answered his mother. "It is a pity you cannot manage it, but of course you must not force yourself. On the other hand, I am convinced that you are exaggerating a little. I am convinced that if you thought less about style, about difficulties, about the poetaster's cliché that with a kiss starts the death of romance, etc., you would produce something very good, very true, and very interesting. Only if you imagine him reading your book and you feel it grates upon him and makes you ashamed, then, of course, give it up, give it up. But I know this cannot be. I know he would tell you, 'Well done.' Even more, I'm convinced that some day you shall yet write this book." The external stimulus to the cancel of his work was provided for Fyodor by his removal to another lodging. To his landlady's credit, it must be said that she had put up with him for a very long time, for 2 years. But when she was offered the chance of obtaining an ideal roomer in April, an elderly spinster rising at 7:30, working in an office till 6, dining at her sister's and retiring at 10, Frau Staboy requested Fyodor to find himself another roof within the month. He continually postponed his inquiries, not only out of laziness and an optimistic tendency to endow a stretch of granted time with the rounded shape of eternity, but also because he found it unbearably nasty to invade alien worlds for the purpose of discovering a place for himself. Madame Chernyshevsky, however, promised him her assistance. March was drawing to an end when one evening she said to him, "I think I have something for you. You once saw here Tamara Grigoryevna, the Armenian lady. She has had a room in the flat of a Russian family, but now wants to turn it over to somebody." "Which means it's a bad room if she wants to get rid of it," remarked Fyodor carelessly. "No, it's simply that she's going back to her husband. However, if you don't like it in advance, then I won't do anything about it." "I didn't mean to offend you," said Fyodor. I like the idea very much, really I do. "Naturally, there's no guarantee the room is not already disposed of, but still I would advise you to give her a ring." Oh, of course, said Fyodor. Since I know you, continued Madame Chernyshevsky, already leafing through a black notebook, and since I know you'll never ring yourself, I'll do it first thing tomorrow, said Fyodor. Since you will never do it, Uhland 4831, I'll do it myself. I'll get her right now, and you can ask her everything. Wait a minute, said Fyodor anxiously. I've no idea what I have to ask. Don't worry, she'll tell you herself. And Madame Chernyshevsky, rapidly repeating the number under her breath, stretched her hand toward the little table with the telephone. As soon as she put the receiver to her ear, her body assumed its usual telephone posture on the sofa. From a sitting attitude, she slipped into a reclining one, adjusted her skirt without looking, and her blue eyes wandered here and there as she waited to be connected. It would be nice, she began, but then the girl answered, and Madame Chernyshevsky said the number with a kind of abstract exhortation in her tone and a special rhythm in her pronunciation of the figures, as if 48 was the thesis and 31 the antithesis, adding in the shape of a synthesis, Yavol. It would be nice, she readdressed Fyodor, if she went there with you. I'm sure you've never in your life... Suddenly, with a smile, dropping her eyes, moving a plump shoulder, and slightly crossing her outstretched leg, Tamara Grigorievna? She asked in a new voice, suave and inviting. She laughed softly as she listened, pinching a fold in her skirt. Yes, it's me, you're right. I thought that, as always, you wouldn't recognize me. All right, let's say often. Settling her tone even more comfortably. Well, what's new? She listened to what was new, blinking. As if in parenthesis, she pushed a box of fruit-paste bonbons in Fyodor's direction. Then the toes of her small feet in their shabby velvet slippers began to rub gently against one another. They stopped. Yes, so I've heard, but I thought he had a permanent practice. She continued to listen. One could make out in the silence the infinitely small drumming of the voice from another world. Well, that's ridiculous, said Alexandra Yakovlevna. Oh, that's ridiculous. So that's how things are with you, she drawled after a moment, and then, to a quick question which sounded to Fyodor like a microscopic bark, she replied with a sigh, Yes, more or less, nothing new. Alexander Yakovlevich is well, keeps himself busy. He's at a concert now. And I've nothing to report, nothing special. Right now I have here... Well, of course it amuses him, but you can't imagine how I sometimes dream of going away somewhere with him, even if only for a month. What's that? Oh, anywhere. Generally speaking, things get a little depressing at times, but otherwise there's nothing new. She slowly inspected her palm and remained like that with her hand before her. Tamara Grigorievna, I have Godunov Cherdintsev here. By the way, he's looking for a room. Do those people of yours... Oh, that's wonderful. Wait a minute, I'm passing him the receiver. How do you do? Said Fyodor, bowing to the telephone. I've been told by Alexandra Yakovlevna... Loudly, so that it even tickled his middle ear, an extraordinarily nimble and distinct voice took over the conversation. The room's not yet rented, began the almost unknown Tamara Grigorievna, and as it happens, they would very much like to have a Russian boarder. I'll tell you right away who they are. The name is Shchogolev. That tells you nothing, but in Russia he was a public prosecutor, a very, very cultured and pleasant gentleman. Then there is his wife, who is also extremely nice, and a daughter from the first marriage. Now listen, they live at 15 Agamemnonstrasse, a wonderful district in a small flat, but hochmodern, central heating, bath, in short, everything you could wish for. The room you'll live in is delightful, but, with a retractive intonation, it looks out onto the yard. That, of course, is a small minus. I'll tell you how much I paid for it. I paid 35 marks a month. It is quiet and has a fine daybed. Well, there we are. What else can I tell you? I had my meals there, and I must confess the food was excellent, excellent. But you must ask them the price yourself. I was on a diet. Here's what we'll do now. I have to be there in any case tomorrow morning about 11:30. I'm very punctual, so you come there too. Wait a second, said Fyodor, for whom to rise at 10 was the equivalent of rising at 5 for anyone else. Wait a second. I'm afraid that tomorrow... Perhaps it might be better if I... He wanted to say, give you a ring... But Madame Chernyshevsky, who was sitting nearby, made such eyes that with a gulp he instantly corrected himself. Yes, I think on the whole I can, he said without animation. Thank you, I'll come. Well then, in a narrative tone, it's 15 Agamemnonstrasse, third floor, with an elevator. So that's what we'll do. Until tomorrow, then, I shall be very glad to see you. Goodbye, said Fyodor Konstantinovich. Wait, cried Alexandra Yakovlevna. Please don't ring off. The next morning, when he arrived at the stipulated address, in an irritable mood, with a woolly brain with only half of him functioning, as if the other half of him had still not opened on account of the earliness of the hour, it turned out that Tamara Grigoryevna not only was not there, but had rung to say she could not come. He was received by Shchogolev himself, no one else was at home, who turned out to be a bulky, chubby man whose outline reminded one of a carp, about 50 years old, with one of those open Russian faces whose openness is almost indecent. It was a fairly full face of oval cut, with a tiny black tuft just under the lower lip. He had a remarkable hairstyle that was also somehow indecent, thin black hair evenly smoothed down and divided by a parting which was not quite in the middle of the head and yet not quite to one side either. Big ears, simple male eyes, a thick yellowish nose, and a moist smile completed the general pleasant impression. Godunov Cherdintsev, he repeated. Of course, an extremely well-known name. I once knew, let me see, isn't your father Oleg Kirillovich? Uncle. Where's he living now? In Philadelphia? That's quite a way. Just look where we emigres get to. Amazing. And are you in touch with him? I see. Well, never put off to tomorrow what you have already done. Come, I'll show you to your quarters. To the right of the hallway, there was a short passage immediately turning right again at a right angle to become another embryo corridor that terminated in the half-open door of the kitchen. The left wall had two doors, the first of which, with an energetic intake of breath, Shchogolev threw back. Turning its head, there froze before us a small oblong room with ochred walls, a table by the window, a couch along one wall, and a wardrobe by the other. To Fyodor it seemed repellent, hostile, completely unhandy in regard to his life, as if positioned several fateful degrees out of true, with a dusty sunbeam representing the dotted line that marks the bias of a geometric figure when it is revolved, in relation to that imaginary rectangle within whose limits he might be able to sleep, read, and think. But even if by a miracle he had been able to adjust his life to fit the angle of this deviant box, nevertheless, its furniture, color, view onto the asphalt yard, everything about it was unendurable, and he decided at once that he would not take it. Well, here it is, said Shchogolev jauntily, and here's the bathroom next door. Needs a little cleaning up in here. Now, if you don't mind... He bumped violently into Fyodor in turning around in the narrow corridor, and uttering an apologetic "Och," grasped him by the shoulder. They returned to the entrance hall. Here is my daughter's room. Here is ours, he said, pointing to two doors on the left and right. And here's the dining room. And opening a door in the depths, he held it in that position for several seconds, as if taking a time exposure. Fyodor passed his eyes over the table, a bowl of nuts, a sideboard. By the far window, near a small bamboo table, stood a high-backed armchair. Across its arms there lay in airy repose a gauze dress, pale bluish and very short, as was worn then at dances, and on the little table gleamed a silvery flower and a pair of scissors. That's all, said Shchogolev, carefully closing the door. You see, cozy, homely. Everything we have is small, but we do have everything. If you wish to have your grub with us, you're very welcome. We'll talk to my missus about that. Between you and me, she's not a bad cook. Since you're Mrs. Abramov's friend, we'll charge you the same as her. We won't ill-treat you. You'll live snug as a thug in the jug. And Shchogolev laughed fruitily. Yes, I think the room will suit me, said Fyodor, trying not to look at him. In fact, I would like to move in on Wednesday.
Treat yourself, said Skobeliev.
Have you ever happened, reader, to feel that subtle sorrow of parting with an unloved abode? The heart does not break as it does in parting with dear objects. The humid gaze does not wander around holding back a tear as if it wished to carry away in it a trembling reflection of the abandoned spot. But in the best corner of our hearts, we feel pity for the things which we did not bring to life with our breath, which we hardly noticed and are now leaving forever. This already dead inventory will not be resurrected later in one's memory. The bed will not follow us, shouldering its own self. The reflection in the dresser will not rise from its coffin. Only the view from the window will abide for a while, like the faded photograph fitted into a cemetery cross of a trim-haired, steady-eyed gentleman in a starched collar. I would like to wish you goodbye, but you would not even hear my greeting. Nevertheless, goodbye. I lived here exactly 2 years, thought here about many things. The shadows of my caravan passed over this wallpaper. Lilies grew out of the cigarette ash on the carpet. But now the journey is over. The torrents of books have gone back to the ocean of the library. I do not know if I shall ever read the drafts and extracts rammed under the linen in my suitcase. But I do know that I will never look in here again. Fyodor sat on his suitcase and locked it. Went around the room, gave a final check to the drawers, and found nothing. Corpses do not steal. A fly climbed up the window pane, impatiently slipped, half fell, and half flew downwards as if shaking something, and started to crawl again. The house opposite, which he had found in scaffolding the April before last, was evidently in need of repairs again now. Prepared boards were stacked by the sidewalk. He carried his things out, went to say goodbye to the landlady, for the first and last time, shaking her hand, which turned out to be dry, strong, and cold, gave her back the keys, and left. The distance from the old residence to the new was about the same as, somewhere in Russia, that from Pushkin Avenue to Gogol Street. Chapter 3. Every morning, just after 8, he was guided out of his slumber by the same sound behind the thin wall 2 feet from his temple. It was the clean, round-bottomed ring of a tumbler being replaced on a glass shelf, after which the landlord's daughter cleared her throat. Then came the spasmodic trick-trick of a revolving cylinder, then the sound of flushed water, choking, groaning, and abruptly ceasing, then the bizarre internal whine of a bath tap that finally turned into the rustle of a shower. A slip bolt clacked, and footsteps receded past his door. From an opposite direction came other footsteps, dark and heavy, with a slight shuffle. That was Mariana Nikolaevna, hurrying to the kitchen to get some coffee for her daughter. One could hear the gas at first refusing with noisy bursts to catch light. Subdued, it flared and hissed steadily. The first footsteps returned, now healed. In the kitchen, a fast, angrily agitated conversation started up. Just as some people speak with a southern or Moscow pronunciation, so did mother and daughter invariably speak to one another in the accents of a quarrel. Their voices were similar, both swarthy and smooth, but one more coarse and somehow cramped, the other freer and purer. In the rumble of the mothers, there was a pleading, even a guilty pleading. In the daughter's increasingly short replies, there rang hostility. To the accompaniment of this indistinct morning storm, Fyodor Konstantinovich would again fall peacefully asleep. Through his patchily thinning slumber, he made out the sounds of cleaning. The wall would suddenly collapse on him. That meant a mop handle that had been insecurely leaning against his door. Once a week, the janitor's wife, fat, heavily breathing, reeking of stale sweat, came with a vacuum cleaner
And then all hell broke loose. The world was shattered to bits. A hellish grinding pervaded one's very soul, destroying it, and drove Fyodor out of his bed, out of his room, and out of the house. But usually, around 10 o'clock, Mariana Nikolaevna took her turn in the bathroom, and after her came, hawking up phlegm as he went, Ivan Borisovich. He flushed the toilet as many as 5 times, but did not use the bath, contenting himself with the murmur of the little wash-basin. By 10:30, everything in the house was quiet. Mariana Nikolaevna had gone away to do her shopping, Stjogolev on his shady affairs. Fyodor Konstantinovich descended into a blissful abyss, where the warm remnants of his slumber mingled with a feeling of happiness, both from the previous day and still to come. Quite often now, he began the day with a poem. Lying supine, with the first satisfyingly tasty, large, and long-lasting cigarette between his parched lips, he again, after a break of almost 10 years, was composing that particular kind of poem of which a gift is made in the evening so as to be reflected in the wave that has carried it out. He compared the structure of these verses with that of the others. The words of the others had been forgotten. Only here and there among the erased letters had rhymes been preserved, rich ones interspersed with poor ones. Kiss bliss, wind in, linden, leaves, greaves. During that 16th summer of his life, he had first taken up the serious writing of poetry. Before that, except for entomological doggerel, there had been nothing. But a certain atmosphere of composition had been long known and familiar to him. At home, everyone did some scribbling. Tanya wrote in a little album with a little key to it. Mother wrote touchingly unpretentious prose poems about the beauty of the native weald. Father and Uncle Alek made up occasional verses, and these occasions were not infrequent. And Aunt Ksenia, she wrote poems only in French, temperamental and musical ones, with a complete disregard for the subtleties of syllabic verse. Her outpourings were very popular in St. Petersburg society, particularly the long poem La Femme et la Panthère, and also a translation of Apuchtin's A Pair of Bays, one stanza of which went, Le gros grec d'Odessa, le juif de Varsovie, le jeune lieutenant, le général âgé, tous, ils cherchaient en elle un peu de folle vie, et sur son sein rêvaient leur amour passager. Finally, there had been one real poet, Mother's cousin, Prince Volkhovskoy, who had published on velvety paper an exquisitely printed, thick, expensive volume of languorous poems, auroras and stars, all in Italian viney vignettes, with a portrait photograph of the author in the front and a monstrous list of misprints at the back. The verses were broken up into departments, nocturnes, autumn motifs, the chords of love. Most of them were emblazoned with a motto, and under all there was the exact date and place. Sorrento, I Todor, or In the Train. I do not remember anything of these pieces except the oft-repeated word transport, which even then sounded to me like a means of moving from one place to another. My father took little interest in poetry, making an exception only for Pushkin. He knew him as some people know the liturgy, and liked to declaim him while out walking. I sometimes think that an echo of Pushkin's The Prophet still vibrates to this day in some resonantly receptive Asian gully. He also quoted, I remember, the incomparable Butterfly by Fiet, and Tyutchev's Now the Dim Blue Shadows Mingle. But that which our kinsfolk liked, the watery, easily memorized poesy of the end of the last century, avidly waiting to be set to music as a cure for verbal anemia, he ignored utterly. As to avant-garde verse, he considered it rubbish, and in his presence I did not publicize my own enthusiasms in this sphere. Once, when with a smile of irony already prepared, he leafed through the books of poets scattered on my desk, and as luck would have it, happened on the worst item by the best of them, that famous poem by Bloch, where there appears an impossible, unbearable gentleman representing Edgar Poe, and where caviar, carpet, is made to rhyme with the English sir, transliterated as sure. I was so annoyed that I quickly pushed Severyanin's The Thunder Bubbling Cup into his hand so that he could better unburden his soul upon it. In general, I considered that if he would forget for the nonce the kind of poetry I was silly enough to call classicism, and tried without prejudice to grasp what it was I loved so much, he would have understood the new charm that had appeared in the features of Russian poetry, a charm that I sensed even in its most absurd manifestations. But when today I tote up what has remained to me of this new poetry, I see that very little has survived, and what has is precisely a natural continuation of Pushkin, while the motley husk, the wretched sham, the masks of mediocrity and the stilts of talent, everything that my love once forgave or saw in a special light, and that seemed to my father to be the true face of innovation, the mug of modernism, as he expressed it, is now so old-fashioned, so forgotten, as even Karamzin's verses are not forgotten. And when on someone else's shelf I come across this or that collection of poems which had once lived with me as brother, I feel in them only what my father then felt, without actually knowing them. His mistake was not that he ran down all modern poetry indiscriminately, but that he refused to detect in it the long, life-giving ray of his favorite poet. I met her in June 1916. She was 23. Her husband, a distant relative of ours, was at the front. She lived in a small villa inside the boundaries of our estate and often used to visit us. Because of her, I almost forgot butterflies and completely overlooked the revolution. In the winter of 1917, she went away to Novorossiysk, and it was only in Berlin that I accidentally heard about her terrible death. She was a thin little thing, with chestnut hair combed high, a gay look in her big black eyes, dimples on her pale cheeks, and a tender mouth which she made up out of a flacon of fragrant ruby-red liquid by putting the glass stopper to her lips. In all her ways, there was something I found lovable to the point of tears, something indefinable at the time, but now appearing to me as a kind of pathetic insouciance. She was not intelligent. She was poorly educated and banal. That is, your exact opposite. No, I do not mean at all that I loved her more than you, or that those assignations were happier than my evening meetings with you, but all her shortcomings were concealed in such a tide of fascination, tenderness, and grace, such enchantment flowed from her most fleeting, irresponsible word, that I was prepared to look at her and listen to her eternally. But what would happen now if she were resurrected? I don't know. You should not ask stupid questions. In the evenings, I used to see her home. Those walks will come in handy sometime. In her bedroom, there was a little picture of the Tsar's family and a Turgenevian odor of heliotrope. I used to return long after midnight. My tutor, fortunately, had gone back to England. And I shall never forget that feeling of lightness, pride, rapture, and wild night hunger. I particularly yearned for curds and whey with black bread, as I walked along our faithfully and even fawningly suffering avenue toward the dark house. Only mother had a light on, and heard the barking of the watchdogs. It was then also that my versificatory illness began. At times, I would be sitting at lunch, seeing nothing, my lips moving. And to my neighbor who had asked for the sugar bowl, I would pass my glass or a napkin ring. Despite my inexperienced desire to transpose into verse the murmur of love filling me, well do I remember Uncle Aliek saying that if he were to publish a volume of poetry, he would certainly call it Heart Murmur, I had already rigged up my own, albeit poor and primitive, word smithy. Thus, in selecting adjectives, I was already aware that ones like innumerable or intangible would simply and conveniently fill the yawning gap which was longing to sing from the caesura to the word closing the line. For we shall dream innumerable dreams. And again, that for this last word one could take an additional adjective of only two syllables so as to combine it with the long centerpiece of loveliness intangible and tender, a melodic formula which, by the way, has had a quite disastrous effect on Russian as well as on French poetry. I knew that handy adjectives of the amphibrachic type, a trisyllable that one visualizes in the shape of a sofa with three cushions, the middle one dented, were legion in Russian. And how many such dejected, enchanted, and rebellious I wasted. That we had also plenty of trochees, tender, but far fewer dactyls, sorrowful. And these somehow all stood in profile. That finally, anapestic and iambic adjectives were on the rare side, and in addition always rather dull and inflexible, like incomplete or forlorn. I knew further that great long ones, like incomprehensible and infinitesimal, would come into the tetrameter bringing with them their own orchestras, and that the combination unwanted and misunderstood gave a certain moiré quality to the line. Look at it this way, it is an amphibrach, and that way an iamb. A little later, Andrei Bieli's monumental research on half-stresses, the comp and the bull, in the line incomprehensible desires, hypnotized me with its system of graphically marking off and calculating these scuds, so that I immediately reread all my old tetrameters from this new point of view and was terribly pained by the paucity of modulations. When plotted, their diagrams proved to be plain and gappy, showing none of those rectangles and trapeziums that Bieli had found for the tetrameters of great poets. Whereupon, for the space of almost a whole year, an evil and sinful year, I tried to write with the aim of producing the most complicated and rich scud scheme possible. In miserable meditations and aromatically dark, full of interconverted patience, sighs the semi-denuded park, and so on for half a dozen strophes. The tongue stumbled, but one's honor was saved. When graphically expressed by joining the half-stresses, ra, med, ar, cal, etc., in the verses and from one verse to another, this monster's rhythmic structure gave rise to something in the nature of that wobbly tower of coffee pots, baskets, trays, and vases, which a circus clown balances on a stick until he runs into the barrier of the arena when everything slowly leans over the nearest spectators, screaming horribly, but on falling turns out to be safely strung on a cord. As a result probably of the weak motive power of my little lyrical rollers, verbs and other parts of speech interested me less. Not so with questions of meter and rhythm. Overcoming a natural preference for iambics, I dangled after ternary meters. Later on, departures from meter fascinated me. That was the time when Balmont, in his poem beginning, I Will Be Reckless, I Will Be Daring, launched that artificial iambic tetrameter with the bump of an extra syllable after the second foot, in which, as far as I know, not a single good poem was ever written. I would give this prancing hunchback a sunset to carry, or a boat, and was amazed that the former faded and the latter sank. Things went easier with the dreamy stutter of Bloch's rhythms, but as soon as I began to use them, my verse was imperceptibly infiltrated by stylized medievalizing, blue page boys, monks, princesses, similar to the way that in a German tale the shadow of Bonaparte visits the antiquary Stolz at night to look for the ghost of its tricorn. As my hunt for them progressed, rhyme settled down into a practical system somewhat on the order of a card index. They were distributed in little families, rhyme clusters, rhymescapes. Letucci, flying, immediately grouped tucci, clouds, over the cruci, steeps, of the Jgutchi, burning desert, and of Neminuchi, inevitable fate. Nibusklon, sky, let the muse onto the balcon, balcony, and showed her a klyon, maple. Tspieti, flowers, inti, thou, summoned mechti, fancies, in the midst of temnoti, darkness. Svieci, plieci, vstreci, and reci, tapers, shoulders, meetings, and speeches, created the old world atmosphere of a ball at the Congress of Vienna or on the town governor's birthday. Glaza, eyes, shone blue in the company of Biryuza, turquoise, Graza, thunderstorm, and Strekaza, dragonfly. And it was better not to get involved in the series. Tryevya, trees, found themselves dully paired with Kachevya, nomad encampments, as happens in the game in which one has to collect cards with the names of cities, with only two representing Sweden, but a dozen in the case of France. Vieter, wind, had no mate, except for a not very attractive setter running about in the distance, but by shifting into the genitive, one could get words ending in meter to perform. Vetra, geometra. There were also certain treasured freaks, rhymes to which, like rare stamps in an album, were represented by blanks. Thus it took me a long time to discover that ametistovi, amethystin, could be rhymed with berelistvi, turn the pages, with nistvi, furioso, and with the genitive case of an utterly unsuitable pristav, police constable. In short, it was a beautifully labeled collection that I had always close to hand. I do not doubt that even then, at the time of that ugly, crippling school, which I would hardly have bothered with at all, were I a typical poet who never fell for the blandishments of harmonious prose, I nevertheless knew true inspiration. The agitation which seized me, swiftly covered me with an icy sheet, squeezed my joints and jerked at my fingers. The lunatic wandering of my thought, which by unknown means found the door in a thousand leading into the noisy night of the garden, the expansion and contraction of the heart, now as vast as the starry sky, and then as small as a droplet of mercury. The opening arms of a kind of inner embracement, classicism, sacred thrill, mutterings, tears, all this was genuine. But at that moment, in a hasty and clumsy attempt to resolve the agitation, I clutched at the first hackneyed words available, at their ready-made linkages, so that as soon as I had embarked on what I thought to be creation, on what should have been the expression, the living connection between my divine excitement and my human world, everything expired in a fatal gust of words, whereas I continued to rotate epithets and adjust rhymes without noticing the split, the debasement, and the betrayal, like a man relating his dream, like any dream infinitely free and complex, but clotting like blood upon waking up, who, unnoticed by himself and his listeners, rounds it out, cleans it up, and dresses it in the fashion of hackneyed reality. And if he begins thus, I dreamt that I was sitting in my room, monstrously vulgarizes the dream's devices by taking it for granted that the room had been furnished exactly the same as his room in real life. Farewell forever. On a winter day, with large snowflakes falling since morning, drifting anyhow, vertically, slantwise, even upwards, her big arctics and tiny muff, she was taking away with her absolutely everything, including the park where they used to meet in summer. There remained only his rhymed inventory, plus the briefcase under his arm, the shabby briefcase of an upper former who had skipped school. An odd constraint, the desire to say something important, silence, vague, insignificant words. Love, to put it simply, repeats at the last parting the musical theme of shyness that precedes its first avowal. The reticulate touch of her salty lips through the veil. At the station, there was vile animal bustle. This was the time when the black and white seeds of the flower of happiness, sunshine, and freedom were being liberally sown. Now it has grown up. Russia is populated with sunflowers. This is the largest, most fat-faced, and stupidest of flowers. Poems. About parting, about death, about the past. It is impossible to define, but it seems this happened abroad, the exact period of change in my attitude to writing poetry, when I became sick of the workshop, the classification of words, and the collection of rhymes. But how excruciatingly difficult it was to break, scatter, and forget all that. Faulty habits clung firmly. Words accustomed to go together did not want to be uncoupled. In themselves, they were neither bad nor good, but their combination in groups, the mutual guarantee of rhymes, the rank groan rhythms, all this made them foul, hideous, and dead. To consider himself a mediocrity was hardly any better than believing he was a genius. Fyodor doubted the first and conceded the second, but, more important, strove not to surrender to the fiendish despair of a blank sheet. Since there were things he wanted to express just as naturally and unrestrainedly as the lungs want to expand, hence words suitable for breathing ought to exist. The oft-repeated complaints of poets that, alas, no words are available, that words are pale corpses, that words are incapable of expressing our thingamabob feelings, and to prove it a torrent of trochaic hexameters is set loose, seemed to him just as senseless as the staid conviction of the eldest inhabitant of a mountain hamlet that yonder mountain has never been climbed by anyone and never will be. One fine cold morning, a long, lean Englishman appears and cheerfully scrambles up to the top. The first feeling of liberation stirred in him when he was working on the little volume Poems, published 2 years ago now. It had remained in his consciousness as a pleasant exercise. One or two out of those 50 octaves, it was true, he was now ashamed of. For example, that one about the bicycle or the dentist. But on the other hand, there were some vivid and genuine bits. The lost and found ball, for instance, had come out very nicely, and the rhythm of its last two lines still continued to sing in his ear with the same inspired expressiveness as before. He had published the book at his own expense, having sold an accidental survivor of his former wealth a flat gold cigarette case with the date of a distant summer night scratched on it, oh, that creak of her wicket gate wet with dew, and out of the total of 500 copies printed, 429 still lay dusty and uncut, forming a neat mesa in the distributor's warehouse. 19 had been presented to different people, and one he had kept himself. Sometimes he wondered about the exact identity of the 51 who had bought his book. He imagined a roomful of these people, like a meeting of stockholders, readers of Godunov Cherdintsev, and they were all alike, with thoughtful eyes and a small white volume in their affectionate hands. He learned for sure the fate of only one copy. It had been bought 2 years ago by Zina Mertz. He lay and smoked and gently composed, reveling in the womb-like warmth of the bed, the quietness of the flat, and the lazy passage of time. Mariana Nikolaevna would not be returning for a while, and dinner was not earlier than 1:15. During the past 3 months, the room had been completely domesticated, and its movement in space now coincided exactly with that of his life. The ring of a hammer, the hiss of a pump, the roar of an engine being checked, German bursts of German voices, all this humdrum complex of noises coming every morning from left of the yard, where there were garages and car workshops, had long since become familiar and harmless, a barely noticeable pattern in the stillness, and not a violation of it. He could touch the little table by the window with his toe if he stretched it from under the army blanket, and with a sideways projection of his arm he could reach the wardrobe by the left wall, which, by the way, sometimes for no reason suddenly opened with the officious look of some fool of an actor who has come onto the stage at the wrong time. On the table stood the Leshina photograph, a bottle of ink, a lamp beneath cloudy glass, and a saucer with traces of jam on it. Reviews were lying around. The Soviet Krasnaya Nov and the Emigre Sovremennye Zapiski, and a little volume of verse by Koncheyev, Communication, which had only just come out. Collapsed on the rug by his couch were yesterday's paper and an emigre edition of Dead Souls. None of this did he see for the moment, but it was all there, a small society of objects schooled to become invisible, and in this finding their purpose, which they could only fulfill through the constancy of their miscellaneousness. His euphoria was all-pervading, a pulsating mist that suddenly began to speak with a human voice. Nothing in the world could be better than these moments. Love only what is fanciful and rare, what from the distance of a dream steals through, what knaves condemned to death and fools can't bear. To fiction, be as to your country true. Now is our time. Stray dogs and cripples are alone awake. Mild is the summer night. A car speeds by. Forever that last car has taken the last banker out of sight. Near that street light, veined lime leaves masquerade in chrysoprase with a translucent gleam. Beyond that gate lies Baghdad's crooked shade, and yon star sheds on Pulkova its beam. Oh, swear to me. From the hall came the jangling peal of the telephone. By tacit consent, Fyodor attended to it when the others were out. And what if I don't get up now? The ringing went on and on, with brief pauses to catch its breath. It did not wish to die. It had to be killed. Unable to hold out, with a curse, Fyodor gained the hall phantom fast. A Russian voice asked irritably who was speaking. Fyodor recognized it instantly. It was an unknown person, by the whim of chance a fellow countryman, who already the day before had got the wrong number, and now again, because of the similarity of the numbers, had blundered into the wrong connection. "For Christ's sake, go away," said Fyodor, and hung up with disgusted haste. He visited the bathroom for a moment, drank a cup of cold coffee in the kitchen, and dashed back into bed. "What shall I call you? Half Nimusaini. There's a half shimmer in your surname, too. In dark Berlin it is so strange to me to roam, oh, my half-fantasy with you." A bench stands under the translucent tree. Shivers and sobs reanimate you there, and all life's wonder in your gaze I see, and see the pale, fair radiance of your hair. In honor of your lips when they kiss mine, I might devise a metaphor sometime. Tibetan mountain snows, their glancing shine, and a hot spring near flowers touched with rhyme. Our poor nocturnal property, that wet asphaltic gloss, that fence and that street light, upon the ace of fancy let us set to win a world of beauty from the night. Those are not clouds, but star-high mountain spurs, not lamp-lit blinds, but camp-light on a tent. Oh, swear to me that while the heart-blood stirs, you will be true to what we shall invent. At midday, the peck of a key, now we switch to the prose rhythm of Bielli, was heard, and the lock reacted in character, clacking. That was Mariana, stopgap, Nikolaevna, home from the market. With a ponderous step and a sickening swish of her mackintosh, she carried a 30-pound net full of shopping past his door and into the kitchen. Muse of Russian prose rhythm. Say farewell forever to the cabbage dactylics of the author of Moscow. All feeling of comfort was now gone. Of the morning capaciousness of time, nothing remained. The bed had turned into a parody of a bed. In the sounds of dinner being prepared in the kitchen, there was an unpleasant reproach, and the perspective of washing and shaving seemed as flat and impossible as the perspective of the early Italians. And with this, too, you will have to part some day. 12:15, 12:20, 12:30. He allowed himself one last cigarette in the tenacious, although already tedious, warmth of the bed. The anachronism of his pillow became more and more obvious. Without finishing his cigarette, he got up and passed immediately from a world of many interesting dimensions into one that was cramped and demanding, with a different pressure, which instantly caused his body to tire and his head to ache, into a world of cold water. The heart was not running today. A poetic hangover, dejection, the sad animal. The day before, he had forgotten to rinse his safety razor. Between its teeth, there was a stony foam. The blade had rusted, and he had no other. A pale self-portrait looked out of the mirror with the serious eyes of all self-portraits. On a tenderly itchy spot to one side of his chin, among the hairs which had grown up overnight, how many yards of them shall I cut off in my life? There had appeared a yellow-headed pimple which instantly became the hub of Fyodor's existence, a rallying point for all the unpleasant feelings now trekking in from different parts of his being. He squeezed it out, although he knew it would later swell up three times as big. How awful all this was! Through the cold shaving soap foam pierced the little red eye. L'œil regardait Caïn. Meanwhile, the blade had no effect on the hairs, and the feel of the bristles when he checked them with his fingers produced a sense of hellish hopelessness. Drops of blood dew appeared in the vicinity of his Adam's apple, but the hairs were still there. The step of despair. On top of everything else, the bathroom was on the darkish side, and even if he had put on the light, the immortelle-like yellowness of daytime electricity would have been no help at all. Finishing his shave anyhow, he squeamishly climbed into the bath and groaned under the icy impact of the shower. Then he made a mistake with the towels and thought miserably that he would be smelling all day of Mariana Nikolaevna. The skin of his face smarted, revoltingly chafish, with one particularly hot little ember on the side of his chin. Suddenly the door handle of the bathroom was jerked vigorously. That was Shogolev returning. Fyodor Konstantinovich waited for the footfalls to recede, and then popped back into his room. Soon afterwards he entered the dining room. Mariana Nikolaevna was ladling out the soup. He kissed her rough hand. Her daughter, who was just back from work, came to the table with slow steps, worn out and seemingly dazed by her office. She sat down with graceful languor, a cigarette in her long fingers, powder on her lashes, a turquoise silk jumper, short-cut fair hair brushed back from the temple, sullenness, silence, ash. Shogolev gulped down a dram of vodka, tucked his napkin into his collar, and began to slop up his soup, looking over his spoon affably but cautiously at his stepdaughter. She was slowly mixing a white exclamation mark of sour cream into her borscht. But then, shrugging her shoulders, she pushed her plate away. Mariana Nikolaevna, who had been gloomily watching her, threw her napkin on the table and left the dining room.
"Come on, eat, Aida," said Shogolev, thrusting out his wet lips.
Without a word of reply, as if he was not there, only the nostrils of her narrow nose quivered, she turned in her chair, easily and naturally twisted her long body, obtained an ashtray from the sideboard behind her, placed it by her plate, and flicked some ash into it. Mariana Nikolaevna, with a hurt look beglooming her ample, crudely made-up face, returned from the kitchen. The daughter placed her left elbow on the table, and slightly leaning on it, slowly began her soup.
"Well, Fyodor Konstantinovich," began Shogolev, having satisfied his first hunger, "it seems matters are coming to a head. A complete break with England, and Hintschuk walloped. You know, it's already beginning to smell of something serious. You remember only the other day I said Kovirda's shot was the first signal? War. You have to be very, very naive to deny it's inevitable. Now, judge for yourself. In the Far East, Japan cannot put up with..."
And Shogolev launched on a discussion of politics. Like many unpaid windbags, he thought that he could combine the reports he read in the papers by paid windbags into an orderly scheme upon following which a logical and sober mind, in this case his mind, could with no effort explain and foresee a multitude of world events.
The names of countries and of their leading representatives became in his hands something in the nature of labels for more or less full but essentially identical vessels, whose contents he poured this way and that. France was afraid of something or other, and therefore would never allow it. England was aiming at something. This statesman craved a rapprochement, while that one wanted to increase his prestige. Someone was plotting, and someone was striving for something. In short, the world Shogolev created came out as some kind of collection of limited, humorless, faceless, and abstract bullies, and the more brains, cunning, and circumspection he found in their mutual activities, the more stupid, vulgar, and simple his world became. It used to be quite awesome when he came across another similar lover of political prognoses. For example, there was a Colonel Kasatkin who used to come sometimes to dinner. And then Shogolev's England clashed not with another Shogolev country, but with Kasatkin's England, equally non-existent, so that, in a certain sense, international wars turned into civil wars, although the warring sides existed on different levels which could never come into contact with one another. At present, while listening to his landlord, Fyodor was amazed by the family likeness between the countries mentioned by Shogolev and the various parts of Shogolev's own body. Thus, France corresponded to his warningly raised eyebrows. Some kind of limitrophies to the hairs in his nostrils. Some Polish corridor or other went along his esophagus. Danzig was the click of his teeth. And Russia was Shogolev's bottom. He talked all through the next two courses, goulash, kissel, and after that, picking his teeth with a broken match, went to take a nap. Mariana Nikolaevna busied herself with the dishes before doing the same. Her daughter, having not uttered a single word, went back to her office. Fyodor had only just managed to clear the bedclothes from the couch before a pupil arrived, the son of an emigre dentist, a fat, pale youth in horn-rimmed spectacles, with a fountain pen in his breast pocket. Attending as he did a Berlin high school, the poor boy was so steeped in the local habitus that even in English, he made the same ineradicable mistakes as any skittle-headed German would have made. There was no force on earth, for example, which could have stopped him using the past continuous instead of the simple past, and this endowed every of his accidental activities of the day before with a kind of idiotic permanence. Equally stubbornly, he handled the English also like the German also, and in overcoming the thorny ending of the word clothes, he invariably added a superfluous sibilant syllable, clothes, as if skidding after having cleared an obstacle. At the same time, he expressed himself fairly freely in English and had only sought the aid of a coach because he wanted to get the highest mark in the final examination. He was self-satisfied, discursive, obtuse, and Germanically ignorant. That is, he treated everything he did not know with skepticism. Firmly believing that the humorous side of things had long since been worked out in the proper place for it, the back page of a Berlin Illustrated Weekly, he never laughed or limited himself to a condescending snicker. The only thing that could just barely amuse him was a story about some ingenious financial operation. His whole philosophy of life had been reduced to the simplest proposition. The poor man is unhappy, the rich man is happy. This legalized happiness was playfully put together to the accompaniment of first-class dance music out of various items of technical luxury. For the lesson, he always did his best to come a little before the hour and tried to leave a little after it. Hurrying to his next trial, Fyodor left together with him, and the latter, accompanying him as far as the corner, endeavored to collect a few more English expressions greatest. But Fyodor, with dry glee, lapsed into Russian. They parted at the crossroads. It was a windy and shabby crossroads, not quite grown to the rank of a square, although there was a church and a public garden and a corner pharmacy and a public convenience with thuyas around it, and even a triangular island with a kiosk at which tram conductors regale themselves with milk. A multitude of streets diverging in all directions, jumping out from behind corners and skirting the above-mentioned places of prayer and refreshment, turned it all into one of those schematic little pictures on which are depicted, for the edification of beginning motorists, all the elements of the city, all the possibilities for them to collide. To the right, one saw the gates of a tram depot, with three beautiful birches standing out against its cement background. And if, say, some absent-minded tram driver forgot to pause by the kiosk 3 yards before the lawful tram stop, a woman with parcels invariably making fussily to get off and being held back by everybody, in order to throw the switch with the point of his iron rod, alas, such absent-mindedness almost never occurred, the tram would have solemnly turned in under the glass dome where it spent the night and was serviced. The church, which loomed to the left, was encircled with a low belt of ivy. In the parterre surrounding it grew several dark bushes of rhododendron with purple flowers, and at night one used to see a mysterious man here with a mysterious lantern looking for earthworms on the turf. For his birds? For fishing? Opposite the church across the street, beneath the radiance of a lawn sprinkler that waltzed on one spot with the ghost of a rainbow in its dewy arms, was the green oblong lawn of the public garden, with young trees along either side, a silver fir among them, and a pie-shaped walk, in whose shadiest corner there was a sandpit for children. But we touch this kind of rich sand only when we are burying someone we know. Behind the garden there was an abandoned soccer field, along which Fyodor walked toward the Kufistendam. The green of the lindens, the black of the asphalt, the truck tires leaning against the railings by the shop for motor car accessories, the beaming young bride on a poster displaying a packet of margarine, the blue of a tavern sign, the gray of house fronts getting older as they got closer to the avenue, all this flickered by him for the 100th time. As always, when a few steps from the Kurfürstendamm, he saw his bus sweep across the vista in front of him. The stop was immediately around the corner, but Fyodor did not get there in time and was forced to wait for the next one. Over the entrance to a cinema, a black giant cut out of cardboard had been erected, with turned-out feet, the blotch of a moustache on his white face beneath the bowler hat, and a bent cane in his hand. In wicker armchairs on the terrace of a neighboring café, businessmen sprawled in identical poses, with their hands identically gabled in front of them, all very similar to one another as regards snouts and ties, but probably varied in the extent of their solvency. And by the curb stood a small car with a heavily damaged wing, broken windows, and a bloody handkerchief on the running board. Half a dozen people still loafed around, gaping at it. Everything was sun-mottled. A puny old man with a dyed little beard and wearing cloth spats sat sunning himself on a green bench with his back to the traffic, while opposite him across the sidewalk an elderly rosy-faced beggar woman with legs cut off at the pelvis was set down like a bust at the foot of a wall and was selling paradoxical shoelaces. Between the houses could be seen a vacant lot, and on it something was modestly and mysteriously blooming. Beyond it, the continuous slaty black backs of houses that seemed to have turned to leave, carrying strange, attractive, and seemingly completely autonomous whitish designs, reminding one not quite of the canals on Mars, and not quite of something very distant and half-forgotten, like an accidental expression from a once-heard fairy tale, or old scenery from some unknown play. Down the helical stairs of the bus that drew up came a pair of charming silk legs. We know, of course, that this had been worn threadbare by the efforts of 1,000 male writers, but nevertheless down they came, these legs, and deceived. The face was revolting. Fyodor climbed aboard, and the conductor on the open-top deck smote its plated side with his palm to tell the driver he could move on. Along this side, and along the toothpaste advertisement upon it, swished the tips of soft maple twigs. And it would have been pleasant to look down from above on the gliding street ennobled by perspective, if it were not for the everlasting chilly thought, "There he is, a special, rare, and as yet undescribed and unnamed variant of man, and he is occupied with God knows what, rushing from lesson to lesson, wasting his youth on a boring and empty task, on the mediocre teaching of foreign languages, when he has his own language, out of which he can make anything he likes, a midge, a mammoth, a thousand different clouds. What he should be really teaching was that mysterious and refined thing which he alone, out of 10,000, 100,000, perhaps even 1,000,000 men, knew how to teach. For example, multi-level thinking. You look at a person, and you see him as clearly as if he were fashioned of glass, and you were the glass blower, while at the same time, without in the least impinging upon that clarity, you notice some trifle on the side, such as the similarity of the telephone receiver's shadow to a huge, slightly crushed ant. And all this simultaneously, the convergence is joined by a third thought, the memory of a sunny evening at a Russian small railway station. That is, images having no rational connection with the conversation you're carrying on while your mind runs around the outside of your own words and along the inside of those of your interlocutor. Or a piercing pity for the tin box in a waste patch, for the cigarette card from the series National Costumes trampled in the mud, for the poor stray word repeated by the kind-hearted, weak, loving creature who has just been scolded for nothing, for all the trash of life which by means of a momentary alchemic distillation, the royal experiment, is turned into something valuable and eternal. Or else, the constant feeling that our days here are only pocket money, farthings clinking in the dark, and that somewhere is stocked the real wealth from which life should know how to get dividends in the shape of dreams, tears of happiness, distant mountains. All this, and much more, beginning with the very rare and painful so-called sense of the starry sky, mentioned, it seems, in only one treatise, Parker's Travels of the Spirit, and ending with professional subtleties in the sphere of serious literature, he would have been able to teach, and teach well, to anyone who wanted it.